It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford. I'm going to be your host this morning. And today we have a two-part show on Fed Talk. We're going to be talking about things that really matter to federal employees, basically benefits. And for the first half of the show, I'm going to be joined by Paul Fort and Beth O'Brien of Long-Term Care Partners to talk about their recently completed open season and the long-term care program. The second half of the show, I'll be joined by retirement benefits expert James Marshall, and we're going to talk in detail about those buyout opportunities and what they mean to you. So if you have a question or comment about long-term care, about retirement benefits, about other federal employee benefits that James Marshall can talk about, please feel free to call in. Our toll-free number is 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. And before we get started, just a reminder to our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, please go to geico.com. I'd like to welcome Paul Fort. Paul, welcome to Fed Talk.
Thank you, Bill.
And Paul, tell us a little bit about what's your job? What do you do?
Bill, I'm CEO of Long-Term Care Partners. We are located at Pease International Trade Port in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We've been in operation since 2001, and we administer two important programs for the federal government. The first is the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program, now entering its 10th year. We also administer the Benefeds Enrollment and Premium Portal, which is covers the federal dental and vision program, and also flexible spending accounts premium allotments. We work very closely with OPM.
And you brought along Beth O'Brien. Beth, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Morning. Well, actually, I work on the account management team, and our primary role is to work with agency benefit officers, both in D.C. and across the country, to get this information into employees' hands, particularly in pre-retirement, so they can make an informed decision whether this program is right for them.
So, Paul, let me start with you. I have a question, just an overall question, and I'll break a little bit from the script here, the little outline that we prepared about what we're going to cover, because a question just occurred to me when you said dental, the dental and vision insurance. I was around and watching both the long-term care and the dental and vision benefits legislation go through Congress, and I remember one of the big debates was whether there would be a government contribution to these programs, and the ultimate decision was there would not be.
Right.
So these benefits, these insurance benefits for federal employees, are paid for 100% by the employee.
That's correct.
So what's the benefit? What's the benefit in having – why do we need a statute? Why can't they just go buy this stuff on their own?
Well, the federal dental and vision program offers very competitive benefit packages. There is oversight by OPM. We have state-of-the-art enrollment and premium administration. It's very easy to enroll in the program. You have a service portal that you can use to find out important account information, change your benefit information if there's a qualifying life event, and things of that kind. There are certainly advantages, and these programs are very popular. We have more than 1.6 million enrollments in that program, touching more than 3 million federal family members.
So even though the employees pay the premiums 100%, they are very popular programs.
These are programs in which there's a lot of value added.
Okay. Beth, can you tell me a little bit about the open season? I guess that's one of the things we're going to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can say it was wildly successful.
It's over now, though,
it
right?
It is over, but we definitely want to get out there and talk about the results, because even to us, the results were amazing. We had over 48,000 folks apply during the three-month period last spring. It ended June 24th, and these results actually were more than we expected. When you think about what's going on in the economy, potential furloughs, pay freezes, what have you, people stepped up. They saw the value of the coverage. They saw how it will protect their retirement income and retirement plan, and ultimately protect their families.
And Paul, the long-term care partners, I mean, that's the organization, and you're the only people that provide the long-term care insurance under the federal program.
That's correct.
And
according to the statute, there would be a competitive bid every 7 years. That bid was most recently won by John Hancock, which is our parent company, and that contract is in place until 2016. We are the administrator for the program, and the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program, which was created by an act of Congress, is the only program that is sponsored by the federal government for federal employees. Now, obviously, feds can and do purchase private long-term care insurance from other sources, but
and
we are
many
the only
of them
authorized
from
one.
Other sources, and it may very well be John Hancock that's providing the insurance anyway.
It could be.
So, would one of you like to just give our listeners a basic overview of why long-term care insurance is a good idea?
Well, very simply, Bill, and I'll invite Beth to jump in here anywhere. Long-term care is one of the most significant unfunded liabilities that any American family will face. Long-term care is not something that is covered by the Medicare program, although billions of dollars are paid out in benefits by Medicare every year. But Medicare was not designed for this purpose. It was designed to address hospitalization, acute care, and post-acute rehabilitative care. It's not something that you could expect to get help from FEHB on. It's not something that disability plans are designed to cover. So you have this liability. Some two-thirds of all people who reach age 65 are likely to find themselves in need of long-term care services or supports before the end of their life. And conventionally, there was no form of protection before private long-term care insurance came along about 30 years ago. Of course, Medicaid pays a significant amount of benefits out, but you have to be impoverished in order to qualify for that program. There are steps that you have to take down, spending down your assets in order to meet the requirements in order to be accepted.
So the idea, if you go into a nursing home and you've got money in the bank and you own a house and a car without a loan on it, you may have to get rid of some of those assets to pay for your nursing home expenses before you qualify for Medicaid.
That's right. There are steps that have to be taken.
Well, it does depend if you're married or if you're single. So if you're married and, say, the husband goes into the facility, they would never want to impoverish the spouse. They get to keep the house, the car, so the spouse, the community spouse, as we call it, gets to stay at home.
But not necessarily the bank account.
Oh, gosh, no. It's an asset. You know, it's a countable asset, basically. The one thing I always say in my seminars, though, is when it comes to Medicaid, you can go down the spending of assets, but Medicaid never protects income. And this is why I think federal pre-retirees and retirees should look at outside long-term care insurance, because their retirement plans are largely income-based. And I think a lot of them are going to earn too much income in retirement to even qualify for Medicaid.
So, and of course, federal employees as a group are probably getting their annuity, their payment every month. That's going to get in the way of Medicaid eligibility, isn't it, as well?
It will.
But if this is something that you also don't want to have to pay for out of your own pocket, and many people, in fact, do pay out of pocket, it's something that you will find it extremely difficult to save for. If you go on to the ltcfeds.com website,
and how do you get there?
The
ltcfeds.com.
ltcfeds.com.
Okay.
There is a calculator, a tool that will help you to try to figure out what it would take for you to save enough money to meet your own long-term care needs 10, 20, 30 years down the road, taking into account inflation. And if you go and use that tool, you will see that trying to self-fund using reasonable rates of return, say 3 to 4%, is a very difficult proposition. Mm. Many people, in order to fund a reasonable benefit to cover the bulk of long-term care expenses, will have to be putting aside $1,000, $1,500, $1,800, $2,000 every month in order to self-fund that risk.
How much does a nursing home cost these days?
In the Metro D.C. area, they're averaging around $87,000 annually. I do have to say, though, that most care actually doesn't occur in nursing homes. Most care goes on in the home. And then the next viable step would be an assisted living facility. So in this area, for assisted living facilities, average around $4,600 a month. And home care averages about $2,400 a month.
And that's and those are the options. And long-term care covers all of those expenses?
Yep, care in any setting.
Right. All right. We're going
That is to say, the federal long-term care insurance program covers care in any of those settings. And I think one of the things you have to do if you're in the market for private long-term care is to make very sure that you have the option to get the care that you want to get in any setting that you choose. Not all policies in the past have been written to give you that option.
You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm talking with Paul Fort and Beth O'Brien of Long-Term Care Partners. We'll be right back.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the government employees insurance company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford. I'm talking to Paul Fort and Beth O'Brien of Long-Term Care Partners. We're talking about the long-term care program, and in particular, the recent open season that was very successful on the long-term care program. And a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk to James Marshall about federal employee retirement benefits. You can call us at 1-877-936-9333 or email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Paul, what's your take on this? You had a very successful open season. Why do you think, especially tough economic times, federal employees pay 100% of the premium? And first of all, what was so special about the open season? Because federal employees can join at any time, right?
That's right.
So what was so special?
In this particular, this event was special because it was the first time since the inception of the program back in 2002 when federal employees and their spouses could apply using the abbreviated underwriting form of application, which makes inquiry into only a few questions. So you had to answer seven questions. Two additional questions were required of spouses or same-sex domestic partners. And ordinarily, the application asks more questions, and you have to produce evidence of insurability. You are asked to comment on a much wider variety of health problems and complaints.
So if somebody has a health issue that might make them susceptible to being in a long-term care facility later in their life, they might not be able to get the insurance?
Yes. Well, if you looked at the abbreviated application, you'll see that the first three questions are designed to get at whether a person is already residing in a nursing home, already using services of some kind that are geared to long-term care, or is experiencing problems with independent living, you know, is dependent in the activities of daily living. And if you answered yes to any of those questions, In other words, if you were already in need of long-term care services, you were declined for coverage.
And then there are some other types of medical conditions you could have as well that might make you ineligible.
That's correct. But relatively speaking, it is a little easier to get into the program during an open season event than it is during the normal non-open season period.
So in addition to the easier underwriting, do you have any other ideas why this particular open season was so successful?
Yeah, I think so. A few things. First of all, I think that, you know, when the program was first implemented 10 years ago, there just wasn't as much awareness about long-term care or long-term care insurance. And I think there's been a lot of dialogue, not just within the federal program, but nationally as baby boomers have aged. Secondly, many feds are nearing retirement, and they wanted to take advantage of that open season opportunity. Thirdly, we received excellent help, not only from OPM, which supported our efforts, but from agency benefit offices, federal executive boards across the country, and then voluntary member organizations, the Senior Executives Association, Federal Managers Association, Federally Employed Women. All of these groups helped us to hold seminars, to gave us spots at conferences where we could talk about these things. And I think the final thing, which was very significant, was the availability of tools and online application processing. It was very easy to go online to get the help you needed online using various tools and then to apply online. And in fact, more than 80% of all of our applicants came in electronically through the online method. So clearly that was very popular.
Right. And I think rather than scaring people away because by saying that the it was a lot easier during open season, it's still not. I mean, your underwriting requirements are still not all that strict. Yeah, because people can get long-term care right now, can't they?
Yes, they can.
Apply. Yep, they can apply anytime.
They just have to answer a few more questions.
They do.
That's right.
They do.
That's
Except if you're a new hire, you'd have 60 days from the date of hire to use that abbreviated application. It's a little break.
We like to think of our underwriting requirements as very much in keeping with the industry. They're competitive, they're fair, they're reasonable. At the same time, we do try to protect the pool, the 270,000 enrollees. And by that I mean we try to discourage the admission of anybody who will not pay in premiums because they're already receiving services from somebody. So if you would become an immediate claim, you will probably be declined. And in fact, that's right in the language of the statute that nobody, the enabling statute, that nobody should have access to the program who in effect would become an immediate claim.
So Beth, I didn't start thinking about long-term care insurance until, you know, I certainly never thought about it when I was in my 20s and 30s. And
no, really,
maybe,
should you?
Maybe into my 50s I started to think about it, and then, you know, I really didn't think about it a lot. But so when should somebody buy long-term care insurance?
I think pre-retirement is the best time. Just before retirement. To give an example from open season, the average age of applicant was 53. Typically, the average age of our applicant in a non-open season setting is around 52 or so. And I think this is the time where they're getting all their ducks in a row about planning their retirement, calculating their retirement income, planning the next phase of their life, that they can add this sort of protection. They'll take a look at things like life insurance. Do they even need that anymore? Can they trade the premiums and protect their family going forward with long-term care? So pre-retirement really is the age. You know, when we're younger, we have different things competing for our income. Student loans, life insurance, families. It's really not the best time when you're 20 or 30. Mm-hmm. It really is that time in the early 50s.
But the premium's a whole lot less if you take one of these out when you're 20 or 30.
That is true, but they don't get it. Younger people don't get it. People in their 50s, they might have been through an experience with a parent-in-law, or someone at work, and see how it really does affect the family. They just get it more, and they have more discretionary income, typically.
And so it's easier for them to afford the program. I don't want to. I've been giving you a lot of softballs, Paul. So let me give you one that because you said I could ask you anything. A couple of years ago, the premium went up, and there was a little bit of an uproar within the federal community because people thought once they signed up for long-term care, that was the premium for life.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about the premiums and the ability to have them go up or down as time goes by and as you have more experience.
That rate increase was the result of a lot of very careful deliberation and conference amongst a number of parties. It was determined that a rate increase was warranted in order to ensure that the long-term solvency of the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program Experience Fund would be there. Outside actuaries were brought in to review the calculations and the projections. They agreed, and so a decision was made and approved by OPM as per the statute itself that the premiums for the program would be raised. And in fact, they were raised for a fairly significant number of people who had purchased the automatic compound inflation adjustment factor.
So the that's the factor that in, when inflation goes up, the amount of your coverage, it'll pay more benefits?
People had the 5%, and of course, in the this particular interest rate environment, and given the length of time people were living, the low lapse rates, other actuarial assumptions had changed. And so it was deemed necessary to either raise the premiums or to make changes. And but what we did was we gave people some very good options that were personalized. They were given the chance, if they wanted to avoid the rate increase by taking a premium or rather a benefit reduction. For example, many people were able to avoid the rate increase altogether by accepting an automatic compound inflation adjustment of 4%. As opposed to the 5% that they had originally purchased. Happily, the actual rate of inflation over the past 50 years has been closer to 4% than 5%. So this was a painless way for many people to make that change without seeing an increase in their premiums and therefore a hit to their family budget.
And of course, I think you also noted that you only have about 30 years of actuarial experience under this program, and as people are living longer.
With respect to this program, we've got only about 10 years of experience, but the industry's been around for about 30 years, and it's not like life insurance or even disability where there's a lot more good actuarial data available. So, yes, it's a relatively new form of coverage.
And as people live longer and they might be in a facility, nursing facility, or need home at-home care for a longer period, that may cause the claims that are paid to go up.
That's right. So it was we deemed it necessary. OPM agreed. And I think on the whole, it was very well accepted by the vast majority of people. We got very few complaints. Of course, as you note, there were some people who were upset, and we regret the fact that we had to upset them. But if you check our literature, we are being extra careful now going forward to indicate that premiums under this program can change in the future, and they will if it's deemed necessary.
So, Beth, as when somebody comes in and applies for long-term care insurance, they have a lot of options how they can design their program to cover their situation. Tell us a little bit about how that works out.
We actually simplify the process. We offer three decisions to make when you're building a plan. And these are basically the same decisions you'd have to make no matter what long-term care insurance policy you bought. It basically comes down to a daily benefit amount, how much you want us to pay each day for your care, a benefit period, how long you want us to pay it for, and as Paul referenced earlier, inflation protection, how you want your benefits to keep up with the cost of care and inflation over the years. We think this sort of three decisions makes the process a lot easier, and we actually bundle them up into some prepackaged plans that about two-thirds of the applicants during open season just checked a box on a prepackaged plan because it really just did meet their needs best. We found when we got out there and were talking to people at information booths and talking about the three decisions, the feedback was, I didn't realize it was so easy. I should have taken a look at it earlier than this.
Mm-hmm. So when somebody has to file a claim, typically what happens? What stage in their life? How old are they? How likely is it? How long will they be in a facility?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you take a look at our records, which are about 10 years or old or so, A profile of a typical claimant is a 72-year-old who needs help because of decreased functionality due to cancer. That's what our typical claimant typically looks like. Mm-hmm. Other reasons why folks are on claim besides cancer have to do with circulatory issues and cognitive issues. The reality is, though, this program's been around for 10 years. So those are the sorts of claims we've seen for the people who have applied. It hasn't been around until 30 years in which more things would come up, basically.
Would be manifest over
time. One of the things I've heard, and I'd like to just have you comment on this, that if you need long-term care, for cognitive issues, you might be in a long-term care facility for a long time, but that the other types of medical issues, it tends to be a shorter term in a long-term care facility.
That's actually, it could very well be true.
Well, it could be. I mean, it depends. Each individual, of course, is a separate case. But if you're talking about risks from diseases like Alzheimer's or vascular dementia, you can have people who are in a pretty debilitated state, Parkinson's disease, for a number of years and who need almost round-the-clock support, whereas people who do not suffer from neurodegenerative illnesses may be able to get by for a while in their own homes or their community, home health care by an informal caregiver, neighbor, friend, family member, perhaps adult daycare, for a time. And then as their illness and their debility progresses, they may then need the support that you can only get from an institution.
And what you just said actually reflects our experience. About 66% of our claims are home care claims. People are receiving care in the home.
Which I would think most people would want.
Exactly.
Prefer that to an institution.
Yeah, and in fact, only 10% or so are on nursing home claims because the difference is for assisted living. So when people think about the federal long-term care insurance program, I surely hope that they don't say, oh, that's nursing home care. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be – because, in fact, only 10% of our claims right now are being paid out for people who are in nursing homes. The other 90% are getting some form of home and community-based care, which I think is really encouraging.
Paul, where does somebody go to learn more about long-term care insurance?
Well, you can go to our website.
Beth, either one of you.
Beth will talk to you about this, but you can go to the easiest thing to do is just go to our website, ltcfeds.com. And there's a wealth of information on that website. You can find out about all kinds of care. You can find out about the cost of care. You can model a long-term care program that fits your needs, your expected needs, and your budget. You can use other tools to help you with things like I was mentioning earlier, like what if I wanted to just try to finance long-term care risk myself? Could I do it?
And then look for us at health fairs. So if you're going to your agency health fair this year, we're going to be doing about 200 in the metropolitan D.C. area.
And will you be at those, Beth?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You could also
go to your health fair, look for Beth O'Brien, and you can have the conversation with her.
And our toll-free line.
Yep, 1-800-LTC-FEDS.
Okay. Paul Fort and Beth O'Brien, thank you very much for being on Fed Talk. We'll be back with James Marshall. This is Federal News Radio.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now this is big news. But that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact GEICO. Tell them, Mike.
Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk, and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202 202- 763-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Bill Bransford, and I'm now going to be talking to James Marshall, who is with Federal Retirement Planning. James is a federal benefit expert. He can answer your questions, and we have quite a few for him. First question, James, welcome to Fed Talk. It's good to have you here.
Thanks very much, Bill. It's great to be here.
Let me ask you, first of all, what do you think about what we just talked about, long-term care? How does that fit in?
It fits in every week. When I talk to federal employees, and I talk to thousands of federal employees every year, I tell them that they need to have a strategy in regards to long-term care because we think about the odds. If we live beyond the age of 65, if it doesn't happen to me, it might happen to my spouse if I'm married or vice versa. So what am I going to do if I need to have some long-term care? And like they said, there's very limited coverage under Medicare, and there's almost no coverage under federal health insurance. A lot of people think, oh, I thought these coverages would protect me. But they don't realize if they don't have a strategy in place, they may find themselves, like so many Americans, when they actually need the care, they can't afford it. They find themselves having to derail all their retirement income just to qualify for Medicaid. And once they qualify for Medicaid, they don't always have the best choice of facilities to choose from.
So you might have two individuals who are married to each other, both federal employees with a federal employee annuity. One of them has to go into a nursing home, and it could deplete the resources.
Sure. Or maybe one of them. In many cases, it's just one of them is a federal employee, and the other one doesn't have any retirement income other than what they've saved because there's not a lot of pensions in America anymore. So it's possible it could really derail their retirement income pretty quickly.
We could get into their retirement savings account and all of that before they qualify for Medicaid?
In many cases, they have to derail all that income.
So you encourage people to get the long-term care protection?
Certainly to look into a strategy. And insurance is probably one of the most popular strategies to protect yourself against long-term care, especially for most feds.
So, James, I one of the things I want to talk about, and we're going to get into some of the specifics as the government appears to be headed for perhaps some downsizing. I think that may be on the horizon.
Certainly.
Buyouts, RIFs, things like that. And we're going to talk about what happens if your career comes to an early end and what the benefits are. But before I get into that, I would like to just mention that our law firm, Shaw Bransford & Roth, which does this radio show, also does two weekly e-newsletters, Fed Manager, and you can get that at fedmanager.com. Fed Agent, directed to the federal law enforcement community. You can get that at fedagent.com. They are absolutely free. And James, I wanted to announce that you have agreed to be a contributing writer for our newsletter, I think, on a monthly basis to get started.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's going to start out on a monthly basis. The name of the column is going to be called Dollars and Cents. You know, cents is spelled S-E-N-S-E. Well, I think Deborah Roth came up with, or somebody on Deborah Roth's team came up with that clever title. So that's going to be the title of the column, and it's going to start out once a month. It might eventually
once a month
weekly.
In Fed Manager. So if you want to get the benefit of James's insight as we go through the year, sign up for Fed Talk. Comes free to your email your email address every week, and on a monthly basis
you can
hear from James, and we have other contributing writers as well.
But I guarantee if they read that that article every month, they will learn something, and if they don't learn something, they get their money back.
All right. So tell us a little bit about early retirements. How does that work? How does somebody leave the government before they thought they might be ready to?
Well, a lot of times what will happen is the agency starts reorganizing or restructuring, or somebody higher than the agency comes down and says, hey, you need to get rid of some people. You know, maybe they need to reduce their numbers. And reductions in force, you know, or RIFs, you know, what people call them, they tend to be somewhat costly. It's somewhat complicated to get rid of an employee involuntarily, but it's much easier to ask people to raise their hands who would like to voluntarily leave us because we need to reduce our numbers to meet our agency's mission. And in many cases, people aren't old enough or don't have enough service to retire. So in these situations, when the agency wants to reduce their numbers to make things easier and to save some money to make it more cost effective, they'll offer what's called early retirements to their employees.
And the words in lots of federal employees, it's visa vera.
Yeah, visa vera are two different things.
Yeah, they're all lumped together.
They're related.
But they can be separate.
Yeah, they can be separate. You got a vera, which is called a voluntary early retirement authority. And so that's something that the agencies can apply for from OPM if they want to reduce their numbers for any reason. They can apply for this from OPM. There are some agencies that have an ongoing voluntary early retirement authority. They don't have to get OPM's permission, like Department of Defense, for example. But this is a situation where they want to offer it to their employees. They lower the age and service requirements to allow more people, more of their population, to leave the federal government and collect a pension immediately upon separation, where the VSIP stands for Voluntary Separation Incentive Payment. And that's a slang word for that would be buyout. That's what everybody hears, buyout. But a lot of people, when they use the word buyout, they think it's the same as an early retirement. But it's not always the same, because a VSIP or a buyout can be offered separately from an early retirement. They don't have to offer an early retirement. They may just want people to reduce, you know, to leave the agency, and they may offer them this buyout, which we can talk about how it's computed and everything in a little bit.
And just because an agency offers buyouts and early retirement doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to take advantage of it.
That's right. It's not always 100% of the population of the agency gets to take this early retirement offer. Sometimes they'll pick a select group of people. I've worked on site with agencies where they were privatizing the function for a certain type of employee or the job description. And they said, all these employees, that either find another job within our agency, we'll try to help you. But if you can't, you're going to be leaving. We're going to be privatizing your position. So that's an example where they may offer an early retirement only to those types of positions. But you really got to read the offer letter from the agency to read the fine print and see who it's really being offered to. Just because you meet the age and service requirements to be eligible for that type of retirement, if it's not offered to you specifically, you may not qualify.
All right. So why don't you talk just very briefly the different ways the VSIP, because we always hear the term $25,000 thrown around, but it isn't always $25,000.
That's right. That's right.
How does the VSIP?
The VSIP is computed based on the lesser of one of two things. It's either based on severance pay, which can far exceed $25,000, but it's got to be the lesser of the two. It cannot exceed $25,000, but it's not always $25,000. If someone only has 10 years of service, they may only get about 10 weeks worth of pay, and that may not be $25,000, depending upon what their salary rate is.
Right, or they could be 62 years old with only 5 years of service.
That's right.
And they could
qualify
for a VSIP.
So it's not always $25,000, but it's the lesser of the two, either based on what their severance pay would be computed. We can talk about that later if you wanted to, or the $25,000, the lesser of the two. And in many cases, what it is the $25,000.
So one of the things that I know comes up sometimes, and it actually does make a legal distinction, is whether the retirement is voluntary or involuntary. What's the difference?
Well, other than the obvious, I'm leaving because I want to, or leaving because I have to. Someone's separating me. In many cases, where they don't get enough.
Sometimes you might leave voluntarily, but you don't want to because you're being.
That's right.
But you're eligible.
That's right. Maybe there's reasons why people don't want to leave, because they're not ready to retire and they don't have any of the job opportunities in the area. But if the agency doesn't get enough people to voluntarily separate and they still need to decrease their numbers, you may find yourself in a situation where you're being involuntarily separated. Not for cause. It's not your fault that the agency is reorganizing or restructuring. But if this happens, you could qualify for what's called a discontinued service retirement, which is another type of early retirement. But if your job is being abolished or if the agency needs to reduce their numbers and they're giving you a letter that's saying you're about to lose your job on a certain date coming down the road, you could qualify for that same pension. It's the same pension as an early retirement. Same benefits, same. You keep your health insurance for the rest of your life. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, we
as well.
Are going to talk about
but
that.
But the VSIP, the buyout that we mentioned earlier, the VSIP is not payable to those people who are involuntarily separated. So if I want to also get this extra $25,000, which after taxes will be about $17,000, I would have to voluntarily separate, because if you are involuntarily separated, you don't get the VSIP. So even though the pension might be the same, the VSIP is not payable, or the buyout's not payable under the discontinued service retirement.
All right. And so somebody who is involuntarily retired, my understanding is if let's say the government's fortunes turned and they needed more employees, they could come back to work as a regular federal employee if they're
well, not FERS, but CSRS folks could. See, there's a difference in the laws as far as what retirement system you were under when you were involuntarily separated. CSRS folks are the only ones that really have that flexibility to come back and have their pension stop and start their careers right where they left off. Whereas
with FERS, all of their job rights and all of
that's right. With FERS retirees who take the involuntary separation, when they come back, they have to be reemployed annuitant.
Yeah, and anybody who voluntarily retires has to also be a reemployed
annuitant. And that's some counseling that you would want to get from your agency's retirement office if you're going through an early retirement provision and you're thinking about choosing voluntary versus just taking the involuntary separation option, especially if there's no VSIP and maybe it doesn't make a big difference. Health insurance, there's a link there. We can talk about it later. But if it just comes to the point that you think you're going to come back to federal service, you know, if you're FERS, it doesn't matter. If you come back to federal service and you take a pension when you walk out the door, whether it's involuntarily or voluntary, you're going to be reemployed annuity. But for CSRS folks, if they think they may come back, they may want to have some one-on-one counseling with their agency officers.
So, and that's an important – and these things are so highly technical that people really maybe sometimes need to get their own advice, James.
That's why I'm in the business that I'm in.
And so how do they get that advice? How does somebody get their own consultant?
Well, I always recommend, to be honest with you, that for free, you should get this information. You should get this, and you should be able to get this from your agency's retirement officers. But I work with over 70 agencies in all branches of the federal government, executive, legislative, and judicial branch. And I'll be honest with you, and a lot of people that are listening to the show know that not all agencies' retirement officers are created equal. Not all retirement officers have enough time to deal with all the employees that have all these questions, and they wear a lot of hats. So if they can't get the answers from their agencies, they can reach out to folks like us at Federal Retirement Planning.
And how do they get a hold of Federal Retirement Planning?
We've got a website. It's federalretirementinfo.com. So that's federalretirementinfo.com. So you can go to that website and contact us there. We got a toll-free number and everything there. Our toll-free number is 1-800-590-6982. But that's how they can initially reach out to us, and we don't charge them up front. You know, they may not need us. You know, we'll have an initial conversation with them either via email or over the phone to see if they even need our assistance. Because sometimes I give a lot of free advice and free information. I spend a lot of time when you add up all this time over the year. I haven't done that yet, but I imagine it's hours and hours of time that I just answer a few questions, and I guide people to who they can get those answers from. But a lot of times they need someone like me to look at their case and help them with their benefits.
You're listening to James Marshall of Federal Retirement Planning. He's talking about federal employee benefits, particularly in there, if there's an early separation. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum. But there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good. Which brings me to the big news. GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to GEICO. So no matter if you're blue or red or in my case green. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, contact GEICO and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host, and James Marshall is talking to us about federal employee benefits, particularly if there is an earlier than expected separation from federal employment. So, James, you mentioned federal employee health benefits. There's a rule on that, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a special rule. You know, there's a rule for everybody who retires from the federal government that the only way that you can continue your federal employees' health benefits into retirement is, number one, you got to retire under an immediate type of retirement. That's any pension that's payable or can
commence. That's not a deferred annuity.
That's right. That's any type of pension that you can collect. And you notice I use the word can collect, not does collect. But you can collect within 30 days from the date of your separation from federal service. That's the first requirement. The second requirement is that you must be covered under the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program for the last 5 years of your federal service immediately preceding that separation, unless you were in a position that didn't allow you to have that FEHB coverage, and then you converted to a position that did, then it doesn't have to meet the 5-year test. But usually, most people, when they're getting ready to retire for the last 5 years, they've been under a FERS or CSRS position. So if they haven't had it, then they wouldn't be able to carry it into retirement, even if they retire immediately, if they haven't had it for the last 5 years.
So let's say we have a hypothetical situation. Somebody's covered under their spouse's plan, works for let's say, works for one of the local county
private sector
or whatever. They're covered by their spouse. They don't have the federal program. They say, oh, I better get that federal program. So they go 5 years before they're thinking about retiring, and then all of a sudden they go out on a discontinued service retirement because they get RIFed or something. 3 years later, are they out of luck?
Yeah, no, they're not. There's a special provision now that if you're being involuntarily separated under the DSR provisions, for example, or the early retirement provisions, you want to take a voluntary early retirement, they can waive the five-year requirement. And OPM always has the authority to waive the five-year requirement, but in the case that you're talking about, you don't have to ask for permission. There's a pre-approved waiver for anybody who is offered an early retirement or being involuntarily separated, and as long as they're enrolled in the federal health insurance during the period where this offer is being made, they can continue the coverage into retirement. It's a pre-approval waiver. The agency has to attach a little memorandum to their retirement paperwork, and they can get it automatically without requesting permission. But they have to be eligible for it. So a unique situation might be someone who's not eligible for an early retirement. You know, they're not 50 years old with 20, or they're not 20. They don't have 25 years of service, but maybe they've reached the age of 62 with 6 years of service, but they haven't been covered under FEHB for the last 5 years. If those people, the only way that they can get the pre-approved waiver is if they're offered a VSIP. So if they're not offered a VSIP, they would have to ask for permission from OPM. Because if you're not eligible for early retirement, you would have to have the VSIP.
So a lot of people who have FEHBP benefits have their spouse covered, their family covered. What if they don't? What if the spouse is covered by another plan? Does the spouse also have to be on the plan for 5 years, or can you cover the spouse when you go into retirement?
I can't tell you how many myths I dispel. I'm a myth buster when it comes to my classes and my articles, but the law does not say that you have to have a self and family plan for 5 years to carry or even pick up a self and family plan later in retirement. It just says that you have to be covered under the program for the last 5 years. So, no, you don't have to have your spouse under your plan to carry or pick them up later, even in retirement. You might be in a self-only plan at the time of retirement, and you're married to someone, and then they lose their job or they leave their job 10 years after you retire, and they lose that health insurance because most companies don't let them keep their health insurance anymore when they leave their private sector companies. That's a qualifying life event outside of an open season in retirement to switch from a self-only to a self and family plan. There's some other things that you got to be aware of.
So only the employee has to be covered for five years before retirement.
That's it.
All right. I'd like to talk for just a few minutes about a benefit that FERS employees have that nobody else in the world has, and that's the Social Security Supplement. At least I don't think anybody else has that little extra bit you get before you qualify for Social Security. And of course, it's now under attack in Congress. There's proposals to diminish or eliminate it.
Sure.
Tell me how it works.
And many other proposals.
Tell me how that works.
Well, the FERS annuity supplement is only for FERS folks, but it could be for someone who's transferred from CSRS to FERS, but it's only for certain FERS retirees, not everybody. I'll give you the three types of FERS retirements that are eligible for this supplement. And so if I don't list it, then it's not eligible for the supplement. The first one is MRA with 30. If you've reached your minimum retirement age and you have at least 30 years of service, you'd be eligible for the supplement. Or age 60.
And right now that minimum retirement age is 56, isn't it?
It's dependent upon the year that you were born. Your MRA is based upon the year you were born. It's a sliding scale.
Right now, all 56-year-olds would have been born in the same year, I think, isn't it?
Most of the people that I'm talking to right now, it's 56. That's correct. That are retiring this year at age 56. Absolutely. They've reached their MRA. But if they don't have 30 years of service and they're walking out the door, they could be eligible for an MRA plus 10 type retirement, but that's not going to qualify you for the supplement. Even if you postpone your pension, we teach in our classes, or I teach when I talk with these folks one-on-one, even if you postpone your MRA plus 10 retirement to avoid this permanent age reduction that may happen under FERS, you're not going to be eligible for the supplement later, because the only three FERS retirees who can get this supplement are MRA with 30, age 60 but 20, or the early retirements. But it's interesting to note that unless you're a firefighter or a law enforcement retiree, the early retirements, the supplement will not kick in until you reach your MRA. So you might be walking out the door with an early retirement at age 50 with 20 years of service because the agency offers it to you. But you just got to keep in mind that supplement will not kick in until you reach your MRA, because it's only payable between your MRA and age 62.
And the supplement's designed to replace a portion of the Social Security benefit that you will receive when you're eligible for
Social Security. That's right. It's based on the years that you were a FERS employee. It's kind of like getting your Social Security early, but it doesn't come from Social Security, doesn't affect Social Security at all. but it's only payable between your MRA and age 62 because when they designed the FERS retirement system, they wanted you to have three sources of income to draw from, one of them being your pension, second being Social Security, and third being TSP. When you walk out the door, you can touch your pension, you can touch your TSP, but you're not allowed to touch your Social Security until 62.
And then because you're so young, many people, they're so young and they retire from federal service, they go and they do something else. Let's say you retire, you get a job making $50,000 as a consultant, working part-time, you play golf most days, but you know you do the occasional work, make a pretty good salary as a consultant. What happens to your Social Security supplement?
Well, the supplement is subject to the same annual earnings test that Social Security is subject to when you try to touch Social Security money between the age of 62 and your full retirement age for Social Security, which is somewhere in your mid-60s. So if you're out there working or if you have a job planned set up between your minimum retirement age and age 62 mm-hmm. after you leave the federal government, any work income that you know, not retirement income, not rental income, but work income that you make will affect your supplement.
All right. And then, the big debate in Congress right now, the one that a lot of federal employees are really scared about, is the idea of computing your retirement based on a high five instead of the high three. So how much of an issue is this, and what should federal employees do if that becomes the law?
Well, any of these proposals that are coming down the pipe, we always have to remind ourselves that, we got to wait until the law's passed to see. But, all this is speculation, but, we also got to remind ourselves that the members of Congress that are up there that are under the same retirement systems that these people are under, in many cases, they don't want to change things that take benefits away from themselves. But
Some of them are ready to jettison those, though, believers.
America is changing, and certainly some of these changes may be coming to fruition soon. So I would choose my fights. What do I want to argue about? What do I want to fight? Some things are worth fighting for. Some things may not be that big of a deal.
What about the high three to high five?
High three to high five, if you've been at the same level of pay for the past 3 or 4 years, it might not mean that much of a difference anyways.
And there's been a lot of pay freezes in effect.
Yeah, that's
recently.
Right. A pay freeze, what's the difference between a high three and a high five if you've been making the same level of pay for the last 5 years?
And what are there some strategies if this becomes the law? Let's say it does make a little bit of a difference in the annuity for some federal employees. Should they just work longer to get their high five up, or are there other strategies that they can do?
Well, the first thing I would look at is there may be something in the law that says if you retire before this day, you get a high three, and if you retire after this day, you get a high five. Or they may say if you were a federal employee prior to this day, you get a high three, and otherwise everybody brand new get high fives. But it's certainly, if you know how to compute a high three, which I could, which we teach in our classes and we teach one-on-one, you can compute a high five as well. And so when it comes to deciding whether or not to retire or not, I would take the time to manually compute that and decide, is it worth it to keep working a little bit longer, even if they change it to a high five, or retire sooner before they have a chance to change it to a high three.
All right. So, James, I want you to tell all of our listeners, what is the optimum time to retire, and how do you make that decision?
Oh, my goodness. There's not one exact date for anybody, because what's right for one person may not be right for someone else. And this is just one example of many where I can help people sometimes within the first month of retirement, collect an extra $1,000. Just last week, I was helping a young lady switch her date of retirement from September 28th to like October 3rd, and it gave her an extra $1,000. So sometimes just choosing one day is not always best for everybody.
Mike Causey writes a column from time to time about the best date for FERS, best date for CSRS. But is there an optimum age? Is there a right time?
It's when you're ready to go, sometimes, But there are some things, and it's worth having a conversation. I don't know if we have enough time in the last 30 seconds.
We have about a minute.
But for FERS people, I've never seen a FERS employee hurt themselves by retiring on the last day of the month. Whatever month they want to retire, I've never seen a FERS employee hurt themselves by retiring on the last day of that month. CSRS folks have a little bit more flexibility. They got either the last day of the month or the first 3 days of the month. But time of the year, the end of the year tends to be good for most people. But you got to watch out for unused annual leave.
And this year it's December 31st.
That's right, the payroll calendar.
It's always been in January. Before December 31st, you got to use up all that leave or you lose it.
This year is unique because this calendar year just so happens to coincide with the end of the payroll calendar year. But it'll be another 20 years before we see this happen again.
So most of the time it goes into January. And are there any CSRS folks left?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I met one of the youngest CSRS employees last week. She was there's some unique rules for D.C. government employees who start before October of 87. She was CSRS in 86, and so she was 17 years old, and she's about 41, 42. So you have to imagine she's going to be working for another 20 years. But they are tapering off. They'll be
all right,
less
James,
and less.
James, that's all the time we have. And look for James and Fed Manager, fedmanager.com, every month. James, thanks for being on Fed Talk.
Thank you, Bill.
That's all the time we have for today. Fed Talk is brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Have a great weekend.